Good evening.
I'm David Ferriero. I'm the Andrew W. Mellon Director of the Libraries, and it's my pleasure to welcome you here. Happy Whales Week. I think this is our second venture in celebrating Whales Week, second year that we've been doing this. And special thanks to Samantha Pashley, who is representing the Office of the First Minister, the Welsh Assembly Government, tonight. Thank you for your help and support and surprises for everyone. I want to call your attention to a program that's going to take place at our Library for the Performing Arts on Saturday afternoon, a film series starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, documenting the lives of five important Welsh artists, C.N. Phillips, Richard Burton, Shirley Bassey, and Lear Williams. So those programs start at 1 o'clock. My role in tonight's program is to facilitate a conversation, and I've spent the last half hour with these two, who have never met before, and it's clear that they don't need a whole lot of facilitation. So I'm going to sit back and let them talk and do a little reading at the same time, prompt them with a couple of questions. But based on what I've just experienced, we're not going to have any trouble in terms of conversation tonight. So since it is Whales Week, we're going to start off by talking about what it means to be Welsh and explain from your own backgrounds where you're coming from in terms of your Welshness. But before we do that, I want to give a little bit of bio on each of our conversationalists tonight so you know who we're talking about. Owen Shears was born in Fiji and raised in South Wales, educated at Oxford and University of East Anglia. He's a poet, novelist, playwright, adventurous journalist, former fellow at the Cullman Center for Writers and Scholars here, where he worked on at least two novels in his time here. The Blue Book, which was shortlisted for the Welsh Book of the Year and the Forward Prize Best First Collection, was published in the year 2000, a wonderful collection of poetry. The Dust Diaries was published in 2004. It's a travel memoir through Zimbabwe following the life of his great uncle, Arthur Shirley Cripps, and that won the Welsh Book of the Year. The second book of poetry, Skerried Hills, was published in 2007. And in 2007, his first novel, Resistance, was shortlisted for the Writers Guild Best Book Award. And it's just been optioned by Big Rich Films to be written by Amit Gupta and produced by Richard Holmes. And we all do hope that it does make Big Rich for Owen. Owen is also a regular contributor to The Guardian. And Owen's collaboration with composer Rachel Portman, The Water Diviner's Tale, an oratorio for children, premiered at the Royal Albert Hall for the BBC Proms in 2007. A very talented, multi-talented individual. Paul Watkins is the son of Welsh parents. His family has lived in the west of Wales for as far back as records have been kept. Can you top that?
No.
Okay. Educated at the Dragon School, Eton College, and Yale University, his first novel, Night Over Day Over Night, was published in 1988, was nominated for a Booker Prize, quite an accomplishment for a first novel, and I just learned that he wrote it when he was 16. Comet Sunset, Comet Dawn won the Encore Prize for a second novel and has been turned into a film. In the Blue Light of African Dreams has been optioned by the producer of Jaws. The Promise of Light followed in 1992. His autobiographical account of his years in the Dragon School in Eton was published in 1993, Stand Before Your God. Archangel, published in 1995, also optioned for film. The Story of My Disappearance, The Forger, Thunder God, and The Fellowship of Ghosts, The Ice Soldier in 2005. A prolific writer for such a young person. Paul is a teacher and writer in residence at the Petty School in Hightown, New Jersey, is a regular reviewer for the London Times, and the recipient of the Hopkins Medal by the St. David Society of New York. So we're honored. I am an old Paul Watkins reader. I've been reading him from the very beginning, so it's a great pleasure to welcome both Paul and our friend Owen. back to the New York Public Library. So let's start with what it means to be Welsh and how that has, how you think that may have influenced your writing.
Who would you like to go first?
What does it mean to be Welsh? I think that's something that Wales, which is one of, you know, the oldest civilizations, is still trying to work out, to be honest. I think that, like all of the Celtic nations in Britain, Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, they do tend to have a very, very strong sense of identity, which was partly formed, was crystallized because these were identities that had to be protected against a very, very powerful neighbour, England, and many, many hundreds of years ago. So although there is a very strong sense of being Welsh, we were talking about this earlier, exactly what that means, I think, differs for many, many people. For an awful lot of people, it is about the language, the Welsh language, which is, if not the, probably one of the oldest living languages in Europe. But for me, it isn't that simple. I mean, the language is very important, but I'm not a fluent Welsh speaker. I was brought up around some people who were, and the names in the landscape around where I was brought up in South Wales were obviously Welsh. So there was very much a Welsh sound to my childhood, I suppose. So the oral sound of Wales is important. But beyond that, the idea of what it means to be Welsh, I mean, we could really talk all week about that. So I mean, I think for me, I would bring it down to my early childhood experiences, specifically the Welsh landscape. Wales is a very small country, but has an incredible a variety of landscape in a very small space. So you can go from the drama of mountains to hills to coasts to rural farming areas very, very quickly. And that kind of, that rich concentration of landscape is something that I certainly associate with being Welsh. And I think a specific note in the culture towards the arts, towards writing and music and singing. For various reasons, these are talents that are held in a very high esteem in Wales and not as part of an elitist culture at all. They are very naturally sort of imbricated throughout the Welsh society, so I associate that with being Welsh. And just lastly, I suppose, which is probably the most honest answer, is that I think people align their sense of national identity with the people around them. So I quite often think of my grandparents, and I think of the qualities in my grandfather, who was a headmaster and a farmer, and all of the qualities of his life that I admire. And I suppose I think of that as being Welsh. But that's just scratched the surface. I mean, you know, I think.
As I'm about to prove, the problem is not getting the Welsh to talk, but getting them to stop. The Welsh singular to the Celtic nations will not tell you who they are. It will tell you a story. And because the Welsh are the originators of what's known here as the Southern oratorical style, that can go all over the place, wander around for weeks, but as long as it ends up back where it started, it's considered an answer. I think perhaps the best way to talk about being Welsh from one of these ancient places is to talk about it from the perspective of coming from, say, some place like America. Imagine coming from a place where every stone is accounted for, every tree is festooned with stories, every family is known by the things that their ancestors have been doing for perhaps 500, 600, 700, 800 years. 4 weeks ago, I was in Wales, and I went to see the grave of one of my ancestors, who was a fisherman, whose name was Silas Powell. And he was buried in the local churchyard, but I'd never seen his grave. So walking back from one of my relatives' houses, this sort of endless procession of tea and cake with jam in it whenever I go back to visit the family, I stopped in the graveyard, and it was raining, and I looked down, and I was busy trying to scratch down through the grass to see when he'd actually died. And all of a sudden, it stopped raining. And I looked up, and I realized there was an umbrella above me. And I looked around, and the deacon had come over and was holding the umbrella, and he said, "Can I help you?" I said, "I'm a relative of Silas Powell." Now, the only thing I knew about Silas Powell is that he'd been a very bad-tempered fisherman, and that one day when he'd walked out into the sea to pull in his nets, a seal had risen up beside him and bitten him on the leg. Now, for all of us, our lives sometimes, unfortunately, distill down to one accidental event that we've never planned, but then somehow that's how you're remembered. So that's how this man was remembered. And this is all I knew about him. And as I'm looking up to the deacon, he says, "Ah, Silas Powell, bit by a seal." So in a way, you feel both very comforted and at the same time incredibly constricted by the fact that you are breathing the dust of your ancestors with every breath you take. Now contrast that to America, where everybody is by necessity from someplace else. Even the original inhabitants have been shunted from their ancestral grounds. And that provides America, for someone like me, a very intoxicating sort of combination of displacement and nervous energy, and also longing for this idea of some place that exists like some mirage in your past, the old country, which can never fail but disappoint, particularly for me when you go clattering across this windy marsh and there's this rusty sign that says Cefar Sionel Gymru, which means welcome to Wales, and this battered Welsh dragon lopsided in this swamp, and you can't help but think, it would have been better to have stayed at home and just imagined it. But there is this constant tug of war between a sense of place, which is both profoundly reassuring and at the same time a great millstone around your neck, and that sense of displacement, which is the lot of all of us here. And I would say most peculiarly of the Welsh in having vanished more or less into the American landscape. If you take the Scots, you take the Irish, even the Breton, and who knows anything about the Breton, you have an idea of who they are and where they're from. But you try and pin down the Welsh, and you can't do it. And that's because they either refuse to be pinned down or will throw up this barrage of stories and allow you to make up your own mind. So our pasts are inextricably masked by the stories we have learned to tell about ourselves and about others, I think.
So then, how did you turn to writing? You talked about the Welsh value of the arts and the culture, but of all the things you could have decided to do with your lives, why writing?
I don't even think that I would ever want to over-egg, you know, the idea that I became a writer because I was in Wales or because I was Welsh. I think I became a writer again because of influences even much more closer to home, because of probably my mother who taught English literature. But again, if you're going to follow that line of influence, you could argue that she was a teacher of English, because although her father was a math teacher, he valued literature very, very highly. And again, you know, if you follow that influence further back. I think as to why I became a writer, I think the most honest answer is that when you're a kid, you tend to be quite interested in things that you might have some kind of a natural leaning towards, a natural ability. I was very lucky. I had some fantastic teachers who, when we went off on school trips, the common response was, OK, class, now write a poem about it. Now write a short story about it. And I think looking back, obviously not aware of this at the time, but looking back, that was a very crucial element for me, because it meant that a writing as a way of interpreting my experience and my life was a perfectly natural way of interpreting it, and specifically through poetry, actually. We were quite often expected to, you know, write a poem. Mm. Now, I don't know if that is exclusive to Welsh or, you know, to a Welsh school system, but that certainly had a huge influence. Further down the line, the early writers that I was reading were from all over the world, but it is safe to say that the writers that had the greatest impact, especially when I was 14, 15, were Welsh poets like R.S. Thomas, Edward Thomas, Dylan Thomas. I'm going to be changing my name to Thomas next year, actually, obviously, because that is, you know, what you have to be if you're a Welsh poet. And so there was a strong cultural influence, but you know, I think I wouldn't be surprised if that cultural influence is in the formative years of most writers from all over the world.
it's a respectable job in Wales. And there aren't very many places where it is. I was just saying earlier, there's no apprenticeship for writing. You're either doing it or you're not doing it. And then if you're a lawyer or a doctor or a banker, you have some sense of moving towards something, and people are prepared to stand back and give you the space. But if you could have been in one of those beer-soaked parties of my senior year at university here, and the windows crying with condensation, and watch as people come up and ask you what you're going to do, and you tell them that you're going to be a writer, and you watch their eyes roll round like doll's eyes, and you realize that you are on the beam ends, and you realize also that you may start writing because you want to, but you stay writing and make a career of it because you have to. So in terms of Wales, it is impossible not to at least consider it, because you're in a place that defines itself like through stories. Nothing. The ancient Celts lived in a world of veils in which reality, or our perception of reality, think of it in terms of everything had life in it, stones, trees, water. And when you live in a place like that, in places that are thin, these springs, these trees, these groves that offer some sort of intangible screen to a different world. If you look up on the internet the word elementals, you will see it's probably one of the few surviving things, ideas that there are actually sort of sentient beings which only partially overlap our world of reality, and that they can be seen in certain places. And you look at the old cultures that lived in this northern world, the Norwegians, the Danes, the Celts, and all of them have different words for the same thing. So they live in this place of overlapping discs, none of them quite matching up. So it seems a natural enough profession. But for me personally, the actual decision to become writing was more of an exorcism than anything else. I had no grand ideas of career or of respectability even. It just became a necessity. I was a student in Germany when I was 16, and I had been put in with this very strict Prussian family. And 3 days before I was supposed to go back, the father called me into his study and he said, "I need to tell you something I haven't told my own children." I'm rushing through this so this can go back to Wales, but very quickly, he said that when he had been my age exactly, he had been drafted into the SS, the Waffen-SS, with the field troops, and thrown up against the Americans during the Battle of the Bulge. And after 3 days of fighting, his platoon had been reduced from 14 to 4. And he'd been grouped together and told to advance across a field towards a little village where the Americans were holding the town. He realized that this was a diversion. The main attack was coming through later, so they were being sacrificed. And he said that he started running across the field, and as he ran, the officer shouted to them, "If I see anybody's face, that is, if anybody turns around," he said, "I'll shoot you myself." And he said he was running as fast as he could through the snow, his helmet on, and everything was, instead of being freezing, it was boiling hot. And I'm afraid to do this because I'm all wired up and I might explode, but he took his hand and smashed it down against his chest to say that this was the only sound he could hear. And eventually he couldn't take it anymore, and he turned around and realized he was the only one left running, and all of the others had fallen, and that sound was the bullets impacting his friends. And he lay down, knowing that he wouldn't make it much further. And after dark, the Americans came down out of the tree line and went through the bodies for papers and cigarettes. And he remembered being wrenched over and turned over in the snow and having his pockets rifled by an American soldier, and knowing that if he breathed, if the man felt the warmth of his breath, he'd get a bullet in the head. So, and finally, when the Americans had gone, he was so cold that he crawled back on his elbows and his knees to a burning vehicle in the woods and held his hands to the melting tires until he could feel them again. And anyway, there's this story which there's good magic and there's bad magic, and all of these are wrapped in stories. And when it's good magic, you allow someone to dwell in something for a time and then you lift them very gently out of it. That's the responsibility of the writer. The bad magic, they just drop it on your head. And that's sort of what happened. So I was left with this story and no place to put it. This man had gone from being my father to one of the Darth Vaders of the 20th century. And I had no choice then but to try and write it down. So the act of writing then became more of an exorcism than a conscious choice to make a career of it.
So you really were 16 when
Oh, yes. And I think that... Yes. And I just wrote it down. from his point of view, or tried to. It ended up being the first book.
Amazing. Writers who you read, who you think influenced you?
I felt so bombarded with, in England, by the time you're 16, you only do three subjects. And I was doing French, German, and English. And that meant that I was reading books and books and books every week, which left very little time for sort of recreational reading. So I was, I had all the classics from all those different countries inflicted upon me. And the first sort of forays out into stuff that I found myself admiring were mostly Russians, Chekhov. Mm. I loved, Chekhov, Tolstoy. Most of those people, the ones I... Isaac Babel, Quiet Flows the Don. Whoever wrote that? I've forgotten that. But these were sort of swimming around. I find I can't read much fiction anymore. I find it like jogging all day and then coming home and jogging, because you follow the same paths in your head. And so I read a lot of history. But fiction, to read fiction, is like having a kind of X-ray vision and this unwanted knowledge of the artifice. And it's like being able to see behind the screen of a film and not wanting to. So I didn't feel quite as if I was following in. The few times I looked at other writers' lives, they were most of them so reprehensible that it was what you were learning what not to do instead of what to do. So I didn't feel quite steered by that, and more by the things that were going on in my life. I mean, I worked on... My mother had no idea how expensive American University was going to be, and I had to come up with... Well, it was laughable. It was only $14,000 at the time, but in today's money, it would be more like 30. And I ended up, the only thing I could do after having experiments done on me at the Yale New Haven Hospital and thinking that wasn't worth it, I'm doing this because they take blood out of you and you look very vaguely crucified while that's going on. And I ended up working on deep sea fishing boats, and that ended up being a bit of an exorcism as well. So it's always an idea of purging rather than following.
You've both dealt with the war in your writing. Where does that come from?
I guess that you're referring to Resistance.
Resistance.
Which is actually a novel about a version of the Second World War that thankfully never had to happen. A version where Britain actually is invaded by Nazi Germany. How did that come about? That had sort of several points of genesis, really. I mean, I think, as is quite often the case, that books can sometimes grow out of the books that you've written before them. And previous to that, I'd actually written a book about Zimbabwe called The Dust Diaries. And one of the greatest challenges of that book was, although I spent 5 or 6 months in Zimbabwe, was then coming back and sitting down at my desk in Wales and trying to make the Zimbabwean landscape really sing off the page, you know, make this veiled live again. So I think I knew after that experience that I wanted to try writing against the backdrop of a landscape that I knew intimately in the bone. So I knew that I was looking for a story to set, you know, back in the Black Mountains of South Wales, where I was brought up. And really, I had one of those very fortunate moments when this, you know, search that I was just starting for a story that could be set in this landscape, that intersected with really a remembering of an old story that I had heard, which was a story about the secret plans for a British underground army in the event of a German occupation. This was an organisation called the Auxiliary Units. It was made up of around 4,000 men. There were 350 underground bunkers that were built all over Britain, but with a very tight concentration in South Wales, around the Bristol Channel, which was obviously one of, you know, the possible entry points. And I became interested in this story for two reasons. Firstly, because the men who had been recruited into this organisation were starting to talk about it for the first time in 55, 60 years. This had been kept almost entirely secret for that long. One of them was a farmer that I had known all of my life, so I went to talk to him specifically. But also there was something in this idea of these rural men, because obviously the people who were in the auxiliary units were mostly farmers and gamekeepers, this idea of them actually going away and escaping into the hills and literally going into the landscape and sort of waiting in the landscape for the German army to pass before they would surface again. there was something in that that was inherently Welsh in its idea. There's an old Welsh myth called the Sleeping Lord and his Sleeping Army, which it kind of brushes over into Arthurian legend as well, which is this myth that the ancient king of the Britons is sort of still with us, but him and his army are actually asleep in the hills, and they will rise at the country's hour of need. So there was something sort of deeply ancient in this very, very practical and this rather rather terrifying idea of these men, and I say men, but most of them were boys, 16, 17 years old, who would have been expected to actually undergo this experience. So I think, so really where resistance came from was from a rather happy an intersection of these ideas. But then when I took those ideas to the Black Mountains and I spent some more time with that landscape, both physically walking in them, but also intellectually thinking about them, I was very struck by a specific historic pattern that seems to have happened in those valleys, which is one of a series of people seeming to believe that they can somehow dislocate themselves in these valleys. The geography of this area is one of these incredibly steep-sided valleys. So when you're in them, you do feel very, very cut off from the rest of the world. And I think this is partly why, because of this geography, that going as far back as the 12th century, there were monks that were setting up their priories in the valleys. Then a romantic poet called Walter Savage Landor bought one of the valleys and tried to recreate the Garden of Eden until George III stopped him. And then more recently, the Welsh artists and writers Eric Gill and David Jones established an artistic commune in the valley. Again, a place where they wanted to live separately from the rest of the world. And there was this recurring idea that if you went into these valleys, you could somehow live outside of the flow of world events. And I think it was that idea, which very much came from the landscape, that really sort of set fire to the book. Because then I had this idea that if that were to happen in my novel and six abandoned farm women who wake up one morning to find their husbands have gone are joined by a group of mostly very young German soldiers, and then over the course of a very harsh winter, they are, you know, they find themselves isolated in this valley, then I could attempt to sort of recreate that historical pattern and essentially give these people a chance to live outside of the borders of the war, which has completely consumed them for the last 5 years. And I suppose what my aspirations were with that plot was to write a book about what war does to people by actually creating two groups of people who are given a chance to sort of not have war happen to them. So it's to talk about war in that sort of aspect of, I suppose, negative capability.
And you talked about your experience as a, you know, as a student, but a lot of your writing is has elements of war, and
yes.
You actually teach war.
Yes, history teacher, can't you tell? No, I inherited, in terms of the way it works into the fiction, I inherited much of it. There's a little seaside town on the west coast called Tenby, which is where most of my family is from. And that was the first school I went to. It's called St. Stephen's. You can still see them. They had little green beanies and knee socks up to here and grey shorts down to here. And as they still, I don't know if they do it anymore, but my first day there, I was six, we were taken from the school to the police station where my uncle, who was the chief of police of Tenby, was waiting for us with this enormous great thing that looked like a horse chestnut, this great ball with spikes sticking out of it. And it was a sea mine. Now, the British had mined the coast, the Germans had mined the coast, everybody had mined the coast, and they had no idea where these mines were anymore, and they'd wash up on the beaches. And the thing they were trying to get us to do, I have to stand up to do this, is my uncle, like all British policemen, would stand with his hands behind his back, there goes my little, and he would rock, and he had very thick soles on his boots, and he would creak like a ship, and he would sit there and wait. He waited for the suspense to build up. Then he told us that when one of these washed up on the beach, and it would be inevitable that one day one would, we were to stay away from it, and most importantly, and I felt that he was watching me as he said this, never throw stones at it. Mm. And one day, one did wash up, and we all ran to see it, because they gave us the free time on the beach, lunch break, and this relic of this thing washed up and covered with weeds, and we stood there quivering like this for a few seconds, And then we grabbed stones and pelted it like it was someone who was being stoned to death. We couldn't help ourselves. So there's this sense of it not quite being over. And it was more than that, on a slightly more sort of sobering note. My great-grandfather was an officer in the Pembrokeshire Yeomanry, which is one of these sort of militia groups that then got cycled into the South Wales borderers. And he was part of an attack in the Somme, which is the 1st of July 1916. And of 125 men who set off across the lines, only he and four others reached the line. And the Germans had fallen back to a secondary line, and the Germans always counterattack. So he fell back. And after the war, he came back the first night and woke up with his hands around his wife's throat. And for the rest of their lives, he slept in a separate room into which his wife locked him at night. Not because she was afraid of him, because he was afraid of himself. And there were sounds he couldn't stand. He couldn't stand the sound of knitting needles. I was young enough to remember him getting up and walking out of the room when the knitting started by the fire, because when the Germans were going to attack, they would cut their own wire. And the sound, you sit in your trench and you listen to them cutting their way through their wire, and you know that when daybreak comes that they're coming. And he couldn't stand the sound of someone biting into an apple, because that, in his mind, was the sound of a bullet striking someone. And there were all these different sort of these reactions, these knee-jerk things, which even as a child one is reminded of. And so it suffuses even the present day. And I think you can't go to these English schools. This is another sort of separating thing I found between England and America. The high school that I went to, Eton, there were, I think they said, 6 out of every 10 boys didn't come back from the war. Mm. And so you live in a place that is... The main courtyard of the school is plaqued with these memorials. And so you live, again, that's image of the overlapping discs. You live with it ever so close to the present, not least because most of the names on those plaques are the names of the boys you go to school with. So you couldn't help finding yourself emotionally drawn to the brink of existence, even if it wasn't your own.
In your experience in teaching now, why did you choose war as your specialty?
I think I chose it because it wasn't otherwise taught. There it is. I don't mean to lean on my own history department, but it boggled me a little bit that they would teach the paperwork side of this thing. And I think partly because the teaching of warfare is more of a full contact sport. I pretty much have to reenact all the major battles to be credible. And I found that it filled a gap both for the students, and I was just saying to you that there's a natural hunger for this, which is both healthy because they're curious and incredibly unhealthy because they don't have any idea what they're really hungering for. And so your job becomes to lead them to some kind of mature conclusion without them having to, in the old Civil War expression, see the elephant. And and it also managed to fit into my own sense of... I teach high school students, and they are on the cusp of childhood and adulthood, and they have the capacity of adults and the enthusiasm of children. And that also is one of those moments which always seems to begin a war but never ends it. There's that old Brooke poem, "If I should die, think only this of me, there is some corner of a foreign field." Well, I remember my history teacher saying that sent more young men off to die than the machine gun. Mm. And so I feel not only the responsibility to teach it, but it, once again, the past overlapping the present and hopefully to a lesser extent overlapping the future. So.
Very powerful. I've asked each of our visitors to read tonight. What are you going to read?
Maybe I'll read a short extract from Resistance and then...
A poem?
Do you want me to read the poem as well?
Well, it wouldn't be Owen Shear's night without a poem.
Okay.
Your choice.
I might stand at the...
Sure.
Lexington, if that's all right. I just thought I'd... Actually, I'm mic'd up. I don't need to stand at that, do I? I can just stand up here. I just thought I'd read a short extract from from Resistance. And because this is Wales Week, I thought I'd read one that has lots of those Welsh place names I was talking about earlier in it, which in a way sort of tell their own history of families and of Wales itself. Short passage takes place quite early on in the book. Sarah Lewis has woken up and found that her husband Tom has just simply gone overnight. And she rides up onto the hill just to try and find out where he is, to try and work out what's going on. And as she rides back, she looks out over the valley. And this is the valley of Olchan, which is really, it's the central setting of the novel. And her mother used to describe the Black Mountains in South Wales as being like the Black Mountains hand, which is a description that my grandfather used to talk about as well, in that there are these five very long ridges. And when you see them in these aerial photographs, it does look like sort of a giant hand that has been placed onto the more sort of lowland, the farmer's fields. Halfway up the slope, Sarah eased Bess to a halt and turned and looked at the long V of the valley. If she were to follow her mother's description of the Black Mountain's hand, then where she rode now was in the hollow between the thumb and the forefinger. The Hatrel Ridge on her right was the forefinger, a long slice of land pointing southeast towards Pandy, with Offa's Dyke running the length of its knuckles. The Black Hill, meanwhile, or a Cribber Garth, the cat's back, as her mother would have called it, was the thumb, shorter and thicker, the last bulk of earth before Herefordshire's patchwork of farmland. Between the thumb and the forefinger ran the River Olchan, after which the valley was named. Sarah's mother had been born in the valley further west again, between the middle finger of Tallaggeffin and Gadirvawr, while her grandmother was born outside the hand altogether at a farm beside Llangors Lake, beyond Allmawr. Generation by generation, the women of the family had moved eastward. Like pieces of driftwood that had floated loose from a shipwreck, they'd been drawn towards the shallower waters of the English plain. It was a journey that Sarah could trace on the inside cover of her family Bible. Along with their birth and marriage and their death dates, all of her mother's family were there. A copper plate roll call with spots of ink that were dotting the facing page where the book had been closed too soon after writing. It was these names that told the story of her family's eastward movement, from the Welsh names of her ancestors that were drawn from the myths of the Mabinogion, Branwen and Olwen and Rhiannon, to her grandmother's Megan, her mother's Ruth, and finally her own Sarah. With each new wave hill that had rolled them nearer England, with each man that had taken them east, their names had been smoothed in the wash of the tide. The Mabinogion was replaced by the Bible, and the ornate Welsh was rounded and buffed into the simpler shapes of English. And I'll just read a short poem. David very kindly asked me to read this, because it's a poem that I wrote shortly after I came here to start the fellowship at the Cullman Centre. The Cullman Centre is a fantastic centre for all sorts of reasons, mainly because it gives you 9 months to sit here in the library and think, and sometimes write, if you're lucky, if the thinking works out. But one of the best things about it that I loved, it meant that you can actually come into the library from, I think, 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, and the library isn't officially open until 2 hours later. So I used to go up and work in the main reading room, and it was an incredibly powerful experience to be the only person in that incredible part of the library. And I suppose sitting there, I was made more aware than ever that every time you enter a library, you're entering a small victory for civilization. Here are the books that have been written, that have been thought, and that have been not just allowed to stay, but that have been sort of placed in this church, if you like. And so it was these kind of thoughts that led to this very, it's a very short poem, a short lyric, which has actually since changed, as poems do. This is an earlier incarnation. It's called The Reading Room. At this hour before opening, it's the reading room that's read. Shafts of sunlight made solid by dust, scanning the wooden pages of the desks against the city's static rush. The sun at every elbow-softened table, the windowed towers, the ruffled bird, all of them are reading from this room, leaning in against the glass to study the breaths above the pages turned, the weight of every lesson learned, and the silence of the printed word, still unburned. Thank you.
Thanks, Owen. Right. Paul?
Yes. This will be very short.
Very short.
Now I get to do the viva voce. I was sent away to boarding school when I was seven. I went to a little school in Oxford called the Dragon School, where we wore blue corduroy uniforms. Can you hear me at the back? Yes? Good. Well, I'll stay this way, just for now. And I lived in a world, catapulted from a world, sort of family unit, to a world of 500 boys, and that was about it. Sometimes we saw girls in the distance, but at the age of seven, that was sort of irrelevant anyway. So our lives revolved around these classrooms, and the big event of the week was the Sunday film, where long before VCR and DVD, there'd be big clattering machines showing us films. And this was one particular film, so it says, we're very short. Nightingale and I sat side by side on Sunday evenings for the film that was shown every week. The chairs were brown with metal frames and canvas seats that gave you wedges. The films were mostly war films. 633 Squadron, Cockleshell Heroes, The Guns of Navarone. After 633 Squadron, the school's shop would sell out of model airplane kits. And after Cockleshell Heroes, the Army-Navy store downtown sold all its woolly commando hats. We watched Errol Flynn in Captain Blood. For weeks afterwards, you could hear booming across the playground, up the Jolly Roger. Then we saw the film Zulu. And something happened to me after seeing the film. It changed the way I thought, as if the gods had picked me off the smooth train tracks of my life, set me down on a new set of tracks, and given me a push to get me going. The film was set in a time that I knew nothing about. I did not know where the Transvaal was. I didn't know why the South Wales borderers were there and why they were fighting the Zulus. Maybe they explained it in the film, but I didn't get it. What I got was afraid. There was a point in the film when the Welsh soldiers in their blood-red coats were barricaded in a little farmhouse at a place called Rourke's Drift. Thousands of Zulus with short assegai spears and horsehide-covered shields were getting ready to rush the barricade. The Zulus stamped and chanted and beat the spears against the shields. It sounded like a giant heartbeat racing out of control, and even to us, the noise was deafening. I was as scared for the Welshmen as I would have been for myself. Now, of course, in the end, some of them survive and others get killed and the Zulus go away and the Welshmen get a lot of medals, which is why they bothered to make the film and why anybody remembers Rourke's Drift. But that didn't matter to me. I could not get out of my head the noise of the chanting and the drumbeat of the shields. It would have been hard, Nightingale said, to hold your ground against that. Nightingale and I agreed. We talked about it in low voices, without jokes or Nightingale saying his uncle was there giving 1-2 punches, or Cuddly in the background making some announcement about his family crest. That night, I dreamed I was at Rourke's Drift. I was at the barricade in a blood-red tunic, and I heard the Zulus chanting 10 times louder than I heard it in the film. It was hot, and I was sweating. There were other people around me, and I heard the sing-song of Welsh in their voices. I hoped the Zulus would charge soon, because I didn't know how much longer I could stand the drumbeat of their shields. This was no grainy, half-edged nonsense dream like others I'd had. This dream had the same sharp smell and touch as the times I had voyaged back home. It didn't last long. It was as if I slipped for a minute behind the eyes of those Welshmen who had lived and died before I was born. And maybe he slipped behind my eyes, finding himself in the chalk, dusty air of a classroom in a faded blue corduroy suit with his pockets full of conkers and a Swiss Army knife. When daylight came, I told the others about it. They said they had had the same dream. At first, I didn't know if they were just saying that, but then I began to wonder if we had voyaged together.
together and alone at the same time, all of us flickering across time for a moment and into the bodies of the South Wales borderers and feeling the fear that they felt. Nightingale wondered if the great-grandchildren of the Zulus ever dreamed of being there, but on the other side, I couldn't get over it. I felt as if my life had been jolted off course. Time itself, the whole order of terms and holidays and classes and breaks and sports in the afternoon and supper time and dorm time and sleep time had somehow run off the rails that night. I tried to write down what I'd seen or what I'd felt. I spent all afternoon on it, and then another and another. I went to Sister Mabel saying I was sick so she could put me off games, but because games were suddenly not important, I had to write this stuff down, and it had to make sense. The words wouldn't come. I could put words down, but when I read them, they did not make the fear jump up in me again. From then on, all I seemed to be doing in my free time was writing. I was no longer just the one who told stories and let them slip away like helium balloons into the sky, never returning. Now I set them on paper and kept them stored like the specimens of luminous butterflies in the school museum. I should have been studying for common entrance exams, but I couldn't help myself. I sat down at my desk with stacks of blank paper and slipped away into the other world, time hurtling past as if my mind had found itself suddenly set loose of the bone box of my skull and was free to travel across the centuries in and out of people's souls. But it seemed that even to mention this other world was somehow to devalue it. So I didn't talk of this to Nightingale, and it was the only secret that I ever kept from him.
Very good. Can you each talk a little bit about process, the discipline of writing, when you write, how you write, and talk about what you're working on now?
Yeah, sure. That process of writing, yeah, it can be remarkably elusive, can't it? In that sometimes it's very hard to remember exactly what you have done when it's worked well, but I know that routine helps a lot, but I seem to be constantly struggling to actually get that routine right. So for me, I mean, I think that there always has to be a significant period of distillation. I'm always surprised by how long it takes me before I actually sit down to write on something. So there will have been ideas for, and obviously it tends to be very different for me if it's prose or poetry. But if it's poetry, the poem that I've sat down to write will normally have been knocking around it in my head in some way for months, if not years. And that might sound quite strange, but there can be a slight a trepidation, I think, sometimes to actually sitting down to the moment of writing, because until you do that, this could still be potentially a wonderful poem, but it's only in the writing that it becomes not so wonderful. And of course, that's when the real work has to happen. And I often think, that's my job, is to recognize when something isn't working, when it isn't good, and to make it better. In terms of prose, for both fiction and non-fiction, once I've started, it's very important to keep going. I'm sure that lots of writers find this, but if you start writing after a period when you haven't been writing, it is a bit like running the tap, and the first stuff that you are producing just isn't much good. And then it's a very steady, slow sort of daily cycle where you're kind of chipping away. Well, you're not chipping away, you're sort of gradually adding to this pile of pages. And for me, that's an ongoing dialogue between print and longhand, really. What I mean by that is that I'll try and start every day by editing the printed out sheets of what I have written the day before. And by the time I've got to the end of actually editing those pages, you're sort of in the story, you're in the moment, you're in the voice, and you quite often find yourself then continuing in longhand. And then you come home and you type up those changes, and you also type up that new piece of writing, and then again, if you're lucky, you're in the story, you're in the voice, and you find yourself typing a bit more as well. That's if it works. So I've got these manuscripts which kind of leapfrog between the longhand and the typed page. And that might sound very practical, but I think that when you get down to the actual business of writing, for me anyway, those sort of practical elements help a lot. Did you want me to talk very briefly about what I'm working on at the moment? I have started a novel which I'm just briefly pausing on because Actually, I've been making a TV series back in Britain recently. It's a poetry series about poetry and landscapes. So that's sort of somewhat swallowed my life. And I had to learn and sort of get to know an entirely different narrative form, you know, writing for TV. But what will be taking up my time over the next few months is that a Welsh publisher called Serin have commissioned six Welsh writers to write contemporary versions of the stories of the Mabinogion, which is the ancient branches of Welsh myths. So I've chosen a story called Branwen, Daughter of Llyr, which, as many of those tales are, is somewhat crazy and almost hallucinogenic. And, you know, as Paul was talking about earlier, sort of moves between this world and the other world. But it finishes with the King of Britain, which I think this goes back to that first question about what does it mean to be Welsh, is that the original Welsh kings were the kings of Britain, and they were very much crowned in London. The King of Britain, who was a king called Bendigeidvran, which means magnificent crow or a raven, really. His head's been cut off during a war with Ireland, and he tells his followers to take his head and to bury it under the Bryn Gwyn, the White Hill, in the city of London. And he says that if his head is buried there, the island of Britain will be safe. Now, what's built on the Bryn Gwyn now is actually the Tower of London. And, of course, there's what people think, or what people did think, was the Victorian myth, that if the ravens in the tower ever leave, then the country of Britain will fall. But it seems to me that, you know, Branwen being the Raven King and this idea of his head being buried under the mound, that there's a very crucial link between that myth of the ravens and the story of the Mabinogion. And I'll just finish by explaining what I'm going to be writing about. But what I loved was that, and this sort of comes somewhat into Paul's area of the Second World War, is that Winston Churchill, for whatever reason, invested very much in this idea of the ravens and the tower. Because in 1944, I think, there was only one raven left, because most of them had died of fright during the Blitz. And also, a bomb had actually hit the tower. And Churchill ordered someone, we don't know who, thankfully for me, because that's the bit that I want to invent, but ordered someone to go to Wales to collect a cage full of young ravens and to bring them back, because he didn't want the tower to not have any ravens. And I love this idea that here is Churchill, undoubtedly Britain's darkest hour, investing in this ancient myth, this ancient idea. So I want to write a story about the man who sent to Wales to get the ravens.
Oh, that's great.
About process, and then I'll say what I'm doing. When I first thought about being a writer, I had images of myself swinging from a chandelier or sitting at a cafe at 6 a.m. and drinking red wine and other sorts of writerly things. But then I realized after I'd stacked all these images up that in none of them was I actually doing any work. And the hard landing is that it's a job. And if you don't treat it like a job, the book gets bigger in your head and smaller on the page. And when I sat down, first study I ever had, with my three-legged desk that had to be bolted to the wall, and I was looking for some sort of inspirational figures, you know, like the Barnes & Noble, they'll put the big writers' faces on them, and they sort of, well, you look around, and you try to find a face that hasn't somehow disgraced itself over time, or somehow failed to interest you. And I actually realized that it was becoming very depressing. I had blank walls instead for a very long time. And every time I felt sorry for myself, I would get up and walk to the window and look out, and I suddenly realized that every time I went to the window, I could see somebody. And it was always the same person. It was the UPS man, tirelessly running back and forth through the neighborhood, delivering packages, and all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, I've been thinking about this all the wrong way. I need him as my work ethic hero. If I can punch the clock, if I can work as hard as he does every day, imagine the amount I will get written. Let the characters all take care of themselves. It's like if you spend more time with people you've invented than with people who are real, you can't make them go away. It's like trying to get the Welsh to stop talking. So, but you have to be able to sit down there and write. And if you can't, then the work doesn't get done. And your greatest enemy in that monastic place where the work gets done is only yourself. So I try to treat it like a job. I find that working in the school very helpful for that, because those students need to be there on time and they need to hand in their homework on time, and my colleagues are running around. I only see my wife two nights a week because it's a boarding school and it's a dorm duty. So anytime. I mean, the UPS lines have faded into the recess of my mind, but it's been replaced by the faculty and the students. And so I must hold myself up at least to that clock-punching rhythm in which the work actually gets done. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm actually writing under two different names. I have a detective series. About 2 years ago, I finished a book and was told by my publisher that it would be silly to waste it on one book because the main character was an investigator. And so it felt like I was being held up at gunpoint. They said they wouldn't publish it. They were so adamant that they wouldn't publish it, but they would publish three of them. So I said, that will be fine, but you must pay for the first two in advance. So this was lots of posturing, and they called my bluff, and I had to write very hard, very fast. But the first one will be out in January of 2000, and pretty much by the end of this year. I'm hoping to be able to publish regularly under two different names. I had to sign a confidentiality thing on the.
So you can't tell us the name, your name?
No. Okay. To be honest, it sounds. They said, give us 10 names and we'll pick one, and they didn't. They gave me something that sounds. I don't know if I can say this. They gave me something that sounds like a porn star. and I don't know why.
It sells books.
It does sell books. And you know. You know, I can't do any. I can't do. No, you should see that if I don't know what you're talking about, then I brought in the confidentiality clause. It's plainly written that somehow having my head up buried under the tower would be. So, no, you're very serious about it. But, so.
How are we going to know
the team? You know what? I think it's going to take about 10 minutes. They said that when the book comes out, it might only be a matter of time before anybody. Before. I mean, what I'm hoping is that I can review myself.
Oh, so we'll look for your review of this new Alexander detective Martin. Series.
He wrote a book under a pseudonym and then reviewed it really badly. He completely slagged it off so ferociously that his alter ego took him to court. And there was this huge court case. All of France was talking about it. And eventually, on the day of the court, of course, only one person shows up, and that's Alexandre Dumas. And the court case was set; it couldn't go forward. But all sorts of possibilities have reared up in the last few months. But it only adds to this sense of the more stories you tell, the more you feel like a walking kabuki theater. That as you write, each thing you do becomes like the rung of a ladder, the accumulated thoughts that you're able to sort of patch through into your soul, whatever it is. And these rungs change from time to time. And eventually you end up with this ladder-like formation that is scaled with masks. And so it brings me back to this whole idea of how do the Welsh know they're Welsh? Well, I asked my relatives about this. I spoke to my these are pictures from a relative of my family, and I spoke to her and said, well, what's this all for? And I said, well, I'm going to speak to you about Wales. And he was, rugby, and also history. And he was very concentrated on the specific stuff, because that they can handle. I said, no, Wales in general. And he said, oh, well, let me help you. Of course, this is inevitable that I'm going to offer help. Well, he started off very enthusiastically. Within 30 seconds, he was completely tongue-tied. And I realise it's because he's so busy being Welsh, he doesn't have any idea how to frame it in a way that makes sense to anyone else. So I see my own writing as I see my double existence, this transatlantic existence, this alter ego I'm writing under, and then the person who has my real name. I see them all quite related. And I think that in the end, no one mask will fit, neither Welsh nor American. And what one needs to learn to do is to live comfortably in that hovering place that is in between. And that's what the Welsh have been doing for 1,000 years.
That's a great answer and a great place to stop. Questions? A few questions from the audience?
Something that's struck me ever since I've been out here working for the Welsh government is
I'm half Welsh. My dad is from Wales, and my whole dad's side of the family is from Wales. And I've always noticed how patriotic Welsh people are. But coming out here, I've seen it tenfold. You know, like you said, you can't silence a Welsh person when you ask them about Wales. And it, for me, it's fascinating. And I don't think you get that in any of the other countries in the UK, or perhaps maybe like Scotland and Ireland, definitely not England. We just don't have that sense of history and patriotism. They can't talk about their history and their culture quite as much as the Welsh can. And I just wondered if that's something that translates into your writing, and is that something that almost helps you write? Just thinking how patriotic the country is, and you know, how much they love their country and their people.
I got an answer for that.
Go on then.
The Welsh talk, I feel like I should play devil's advocate and disagree and say, no, it's all right, I'm not really disagreeing. that the Scots I know and the Irish I know and the English I know are fiercely, fiercely proud of where they've come from. But they don't have, the reason the Welsh do so much talking about it, so much experience, is because they have to. If you think about the Scots, they have a tidy perception. They have given to the world a tidy perception of who they are and what their temperament is. And so have the Irish. And, I mean, during the First World War, when they barracked Irish soldiers, they would never barrack them next to the English because of this perceived temperament that they had and the fighting qualities. And they wouldn't barrack them next to the Scots either. Always barrack the Welsh next to the Irish. And they said that was because it took a Welshman to understand an Irishman, which was more than you could say for the Irishman. So there's this sense of a charmingly prepackaged and a healthily prepackaged sense of identity. But lacking that, the Welsh must resort, I think, to this kind of beautifully scattershot interpretation of themselves. I don't mean to take away from any of those countries, but what I've seen since I came here is, I mean, we could broaden this way beyond the British Isles, this pride of former place. And it's true that in the absence of the real country, that those things which are totemic, those symbols of where you've come from, become in this place of displacement, this America, all the more important. And if you don't have a frame of reference, like 98% of my family, they don't matter. I mean, the things that will have me in tears, and they walk through every day. And so it's not that they aren't sacred. It's just that when you live with the sacred every day, you learn to be quiet about it. It's not a problem I've ever had.
To come back to your point about, you know, that a strong sense of cultural identity over here, I mean, I think that what Paul says is right, is that when any sort of, you know, groups of people are away from their home country, there is going to be a slightly sort of increased sense of that cultural identity and perhaps an element of tribalism, you know. But in terms of how that relates in the British Isles, I really do trace it back to the fact that the English culture, when devolution happened, one of the most interesting consequences of devolution was that the St. George's Cross, the English flag, which hadn't been seen anywhere for a long, long time, and it was associated with racism and the BNP, started to reemerge. And there were increasingly articles in the newspapers about, hold on, so Wales has the Welsh Assembly, Scottish has the Scottish Parliament. What does it actually mean to be English? And I think you're right. I've known lots and lots of friends who are almost envious of that strong sense of cultural identity. And for me, it does go back to the fact that England historically was an imperial culture and also has been formed linguistically and socially by a series of invasions, Roman, a Norman, Anglo-Saxon, whereas the Celtic nations, both linguistically and culturally, really haven't to the same degree. What they have all had at some point is England attack them and oppress them and build castles and and making it law that you shouldn't be able to speak your own language in your own land. And so the Celtic nations have become, their cultural identity has become crystallized as a from a position of having to defend it. And I think that one of the most positive outcomes of devolution is that there's been a very positive appraisal of what does it mean to be English. And now the St. George's Cross is everywhere, and there's a much stronger sense of these individual identities, but still within the Union. And I mean, it's quite a remarkable feat. I did an event in Zagreb not that long ago, and every event that we did, especially in the schools, they were fascinated by the nature of the United Kingdom, that there was this union of these very distinct, these very different cultures. Because we're talking a bit about this, you know, this a scattershot idea of being Welsh. But actually, I think at the same time, there's a very strong understanding of actually what it means and what it stands for. And of course, I suddenly realised that there was this fascination in Zagreb, because they just very recently had a horrific and a very, very bloody war. And so they were trying to understand how could you have these different languages, these different cultural identities, and yet still have one union. And of course, we had to say, well, we had our bloody wars hundreds and hundreds of years ago. But it is possible. It is possible. So I think that Britain and its four, you know, different cultural identities is still undergoing an absolutely fascinating period at the moment. And what's been happening in Northern Ireland and with Stormont, it's all just, you know, that process is still very much happening now, but happening at an incredible rate. So I think you're right. There's a lot of very recent awareness and questioning of what these cultural identities are and what they mean.
One of the comments that has been made about Israel is too small territory, too much history. Wales is a small country. It is being impacted by diversity. Irish, Poles, Ukrainians, Asian Indians. It's being impacted by the European Union, by globalization, by international communication, by the European Union, with all that that implies and with all of the appeal that it has. Does either of you have any notion what will happen, what is happening in the school system to give this diverse population living in this small country a sense of Welshness?
It's an interesting question, because the diverse populations of Wales are in very specific parts of Wales. They're in the urban areas, in the south, in Cardiff and Swansea. But actually, we were talking before how there's been, since the 1920s, 1930s, a very strong Italian population in Wales. So this isn't something that is that new. The largest population of Somalilanders outside of Somaliland is in Cardiff. But the more significant recent change, you know, in the cultural makeup, you're quite right, has been from, you know, the former Eastern Europe and from Poland. And I don't think I'm qualified to really sort of comment on, you know, on the social structure and how that is changing. I mean, I know that in terms of within the EU, I mean, Wales has always seen the European Union as an incredibly positive force, because a European Union of small regions will only ever benefit Wales. And there are some people in Wales who would say that increasingly the ties aren't between Wales and England, but between Wales and Europe. I suppose the most significant change in the schools in Wales recently has been in terms of Welsh language, in the fact that when I was going to school in Wales, Welsh wasn't even taught as a foreign language. You know, I wasn't even allowed to learn it. You know, that was under the Thatcherite government. And that was when there was a Welsh office in London, and the Welsh minister wasn't Welsh and actually hadn't ever been to Wales. You know, and it's all of this sort of stuff that we couldn't even conceive of now, amazingly. But since then, there's been a huge resurgence in the Welsh language, so that my younger brother was able to go through Welsh medium education, and he's only 9 years younger than me. So I think that there is a very definite sense of Welshness in Wales. And from what I've seen in the schools I've been to in Cardiff, that Welshness seems to assimilate other cultures and other people, almost, I'd say, as well as, you know, New York assimilates all of those other cultures, and people feel like a New Yorker first and then whatever they are second. And of course, it's always generational. If you're born in Wales, I think you probably have your Welshness, you know, sort of beaten over your head, you know, from a very early age.
Thank you. Yeah. In the 1950s, when one of my uncles was teaching, It was at a place called the Dinas Lower School, Dinas Head, just outside Fishguard. He had to post a boy at the edge of the school down the driveway with a bell, because, and every time a car went past, the boy would ring the bell, because my uncle was teaching in Welsh, which was illegal at the time. And when they rang the bell, it switched to English and then go back again. But he said there were boys coming in from the hills, farm boys, who didn't speak proper English, and they needed to learn in Welsh. And as I understand it, there's only one class now in the Welsh school system which you absolutely have to take, and that's Welsh. You can be airdropped out of God knows where, and you go into school, in the first class you have to learn Welsh. Whether that will translate into a coherent, multiracial landscape, I don't think that Wales is... I suppose landscape's the right word. I don't think it's a big enough country. I don't think it's energetic enough in a sense of being industrialized enough. I mean, when you think of New York, I think of... Whenever I walk out of the bus station, I feel like I'm walking into a thunderstorm. It's as if someone just stabbed me in the heart with adrenaline. Well, that comes from this vast melting pot. And Wales, I think, has that, but in a sense that is not decades old or even centuries old, but millennia old. And so their concept of the melting is very, very is glacial in its movement. It's true, we can point to the Vikings. The names of my family are from. Fishguard is Fiskegard, which is a Viking word, which means the place where you can catch fish. Tenby is Tenby, which means the bay where you can get tin. These are Viking words. And that the Welsh have taken them over. Abergwein, Dinbych Abysgod. It is irrelevant, really, because these places were populated, and before that, by the Vikings, by the Flemish weavers, before that, by a tribe. The Western Welsh were a tribe known as the Desai. And the Desai were as populous on the east coast of Ireland as they were on the west coast of Wales. So this is not unknown. And that it is happening now in this sort of ripple effect, I see as almost like the formation of a stalactite, very slow and perhaps successful and perhaps not. But the language will serve at least to run like some kind of arterial flow through whatever it emerges from it.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for joining us tonight. There are copies of their books for sale, and they will sign tonight. Thanks. Thank you.